This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Good evening. We begin tonight with the search for survivors in Turkey and northern Syria after one of the strongest earthquakes on record struck the area at the worst time imaginable, early in the morning, with most people at home. Those are just two buildings, two of more than 5,600 that have collapsed in the quake, the aftershocks, and the aftermath on the Turkish side. Already in Turkey and Syria, nearly 4,000 people are known to have died, according to Turkish officials and Syrian state media. The number has been climbing with each new update. Nearly 19,000 more are said to be injured. A major international aid effort is gearing up, but the priority right now is search and rescue. Take a look. This is video from CNN Turk from a town close to where the quake was centered. For the last several hours now, we have been watching crews there trying to make their way to a 14-year-old child trapped in the wreckage of a two-story building. They go as quickly as they can, but it is delicate and dangerous work, and the team stopped at one point to try to work out how to proceed. It's unclear what the teen's condition is. We do know, however, this is hardly the only such scene across the area. There are many. CNN's Jemana Karachi joins us now from Istanbul. What is the latest, Jemana?
Anderson, utter devastation across what is this massive earthquake zone that stretches across 10 provinces in southern Turkey and across the border into government-controlled parts of Syria, as well as the rebel-held northwest of the country. And we're talking about a part of Syria that where you find some of the country's most vulnerable women and children who have been displaced several times over the past more than a decade of civil war. These are people who are entirely reliant on international aid. And this is coming at a time where they have been facing a very, very harsh winter. Couldn't have happened at a worse time for the population in northwestern Syria, as well as here in southern Turkey as well. As you mentioned earlier, Anderson, the death toll continuing to rise. The latest figures we have, more than 3,800 people confirmed killed in both countries. And the fear right now is that casualty figures are going to rise significantly in the coming hours and days.
Flattened in seconds. Moments later, two aftershocks. A Turkish TV crew reporting live during the makings of an apocalyptic scene. The reporter grabbing a young girl as the rubble and smoke settles around them. Rescue efforts beginning immediately. In southern Turkey, a young man trapped. Desperation in his eyes. Then, in the pre-dawn darkness, a moment of joy. Hauled from the wreckage. This was a residential building full of families asleep in their homes when the massive earthquake struck.
I was sleeping when my wife suddenly woke me up. The quake was very severe, very scary. It took almost 2 minutes until the shaking stopped.
As the hours go by, more rescues. Hospitals also begin to overflow. Reported deaths going up by the hundreds each hour. Millions impacted. In Syria, a father cries over his baby's limp body. Many children among the killed and injured. It's unclear just how many are still trapped and how many have lost their lives.
There are 12 families and no one managed to get out. They are all inside here.
The White Helmets have done this before. Heroes of the Syrian civil war, now pulling people out from under a very different disaster. So many in rebel-held northern Syria had very little yesterday. Many had already lost everything, displaced and reeling from years of war.
It's a disaster. All the floors crumbled into ruins. We need a month, maybe even 3 months, to recover our dead.
A winter storm hitting the region, only exacerbating the dire situation and slowing rescue efforts. In Turkey, too, foreign help will be needed. World leaders are already pledging and deploying rescue teams. The search and rescue will stretch on for days, hope remaining as long as possible.
I mean, Jemana, you have freezing temperatures, aftershocks continuing to hit the region. How hampered are these rescue efforts right now in Turkey and Syria?
Well, they are continuing, Anderson, but as you can imagine, it's nighttime here. It's dark. This has definitely slowed down the search and rescue operations that have been ongoing now nearly for 24 hours. The rescue workers are dealing with so many challenges. The weather, of course, it is freezing. It is snowing. Many roads are blocked, making it very difficult for them to access a lot of these areas. And they've got low visibility being reported in some areas as well. Many challenges that they are facing. And one of the issues we've heard from Turkish officials, Anderson is saying, is the fact that this is such a vast area that they have to deal with. It's not contained in one province or two. We're talking about a large area, 10 provinces, millions of people living in those areas across southern Turkey. So a very, very complex search and rescue operation, of course. International aid and support that Turkey has requested is beginning to arrive. And we are hearing from aid agencies and Syrians in northwestern Syria calling on the international community also to act urgently and do more to provide support and assistance for these parts of Syria that are in no way equipped to deal with yet another humanitarian disaster that's unfolding, Anderson.
Yeah. Jemana Karaci, I appreciate it from Istanbul. Joining us now is structural engineer Kit Miyamoto, who will be heading to Turkey tomorrow to join a team from his company that's already on the ground. Kit, I appreciate you being with us. We are, you know, we're watching these rescues underway. We're seeing these buildings continue to collapse with aftershocks. We understand a 14-year-old child is trapped in one of them. Can you explain just how, at this stage, search and rescue teams approach this? I mean, because it seems like in a lot of places are not, it's not expert search and rescue teams, it's local police, it's civilians just trying to do what they can.
Exactly. I mean, this earthquake is a massive one. I'm talking about the rupture length of fault line exceeded 120 kilometers. It's a long area, big area affected by it. Estimated almost 10 million to almost up to 20 million people affected by strong motion. You're talking about the 15-20% of country affected by this, right? So it's definitely the massive effort. And you've seen the clips from the cities, but there's also the rural area now where that's a lot of a smaller, like a unreinforced masonry brick buildings exist. Those are really dangerous too. So those extent of damage in a rural area has not been seen yet, you know? So there will be a lot more come up there.
When you see these buildings collapse, I mean, the only thing I have to really compare it to is the earthquake in Port-au-Prince in Haiti, some estimates as high as 200,000 people killed in that. Those structures were smaller, obviously a lot of poor construction there. How do the structures here compare, and how much of part of the problem is that?
Well, the Turkey does have the one of the best engineers in the world, quite frankly. I mean, they are good. You know, building code is the same as California. It's just everything there. But the older stock of buildings, that building code changed there in about 1997. So anything before like 2000, they don't really meet the so-called earthquake criteria. So risk of that. And also it's all coming up not about code, right? It's about the how the contractors and masons they implement on the field. And there's a definitely lack of it in many cases. So actually, the estimation from our engineers is 1 out of 10 buildings collapse. They're actually newer construction.
Hmm. So what do you expect to find in the countryside? And how does, you know, I mean, how long an effort is this to even just try to recover people?
Well, this is going to be the probably biggest natural disaster the Turkish nation experiencing in modern times. So I think Turkey is a strong country, you know, and got great engineers and everything, but they definitely need our support, international support. That is, there's no doubt in my mind, and also Syria for sure.
Kim Miyamoto, I'm glad you're heading over there, and our best to you and everybody who is trying to help. Appreciate it. We turn now to the Chinese spy balloon. CNN's Josh Campbell reports that wreckage of it has started arriving. The FBI's lab in Quantico, Virginia, and 2 days after an Air Force F-22 shot it out of the sky off the South Carolina coast. That is only part of the picture. There's also the Pentagon claim that there were three others like it during the previous administration, something several former officials, including former National Security Advisor John Bolton, disputed over the weekend. A senior current official tells CNN that the intelligence community is prepared to brief key members of the former administration, several of them telling us they have yet to be contacted. As for how those three other incidents went undiscovered until after the fact, NORAD's commanding general used a phrase you might not have heard before to explain.
I will tell you that we did not detect those threats. And that's a domain awareness gap that we have to figure out. But I don't want to go in further detail.
Further details such as exactly what a domain awareness gap is may be akin to a FUBAR gap. That's just a guess, though. CNN's chief law enforcement and intelligence analyst John Miller joins us now with more of what the FBI analysts could learn. Can you just walk us through like what the FBI is doing right now at Quantico?
So when they bring these pieces and parts from 47 feet beneath the ocean surface, it goes to the Marine base at Quantico, where the FBI has its academy and its lab. But off in the corner, away from all the other buildings, is a very short complex called OTD. It's the Operational Technology Division. These are the scientists, the engineers, the special agents, the electronics whizzes who actually build the FBI's most sophisticated surveillance equipment. And what they'll do is they'll look at these parts and they'll say, this is a piece of something we recognize. This part fits with that part. This comes from something whose capability is X. But what they'll try to do is forensically put together what was on that balloon as the payload and what was it designed to do.
The FBI has said it's the size of a regional jet. I mean, this is a huge thing.
A huge
and
payload.
Plummeting through the sky into the ocean, the damage has got to be pretty extreme.
Pretty extreme, but not as extreme necessarily as it would have been if it were shot down over some vast, unoccupied place in Montana. But here's where the people at OTD are going to make their money or not, or earn their money or not, is not just helping, and they'll have help from the NRO, the National Reconnaissance Office, the NSA people, CIA people, experts in Chinese surveillance technology. But where they really earn their money is if they're able to find that piece where they have it intact enough or can repair it enough to download data and see what was being vacuumed up into those surveillance technologies and what was being sent back.
I want to ask you finally, you were on the program just, a couple of days ago, talking about threats to the electrical grid, particularly from white supremacist groups or neo-Nazi groups. We just got news now that there was a power plot, grid plot, being described as a neo-Nazi leader. I'm not sure how much of a leader he actually was. And some woman from Maryland who he was linked with were planning to attack electrical substations encircling Baltimore to, quote, completely destroy the entire city, and that would spark some sort of a race war that white people would then take over, according to them.
This is literally everything we were talking about on this broadcast Friday night come to fruition. This was a real plot run by a neo-Nazi leader who used to run the Atomwaffen Division. Mm-hmm. Now it's been renamed as something else.
Which sounds very large. I imagine it's a relatively small group.
Relatively small, but they operate online, so they're not all in one place and not all together, but they get acolytes mm-hmm. in these chat rooms in the darkest corners of the internet. Mm-hmm. And he finds her, she finds him. They find a third individual who turns out to be an FBI source. But they're talking about hitting multiple substations, doing the kind of damage to equipment in their planning that would take months to replace. They're hoping to plunge Baltimore into a blackout that's going to lead to looting and riots and a race war and all of the things that come in the documents that are the playbooks for this. And it's just become a theme of this kind of right-wing accelerationist neo-Nazi movement online.
It's fascinating. The timing was just incredible. That's John Miller. Thank you so much. Coming up next, a look ahead to tomorrow night's State of the Union speech, the accomplishments that President Biden will likely point to, which nearly 2 in 3 Americans in new polling say they just do not see. And later, new developments in one of several investigations of Congressman George Santos, just days after the latest new allegation surfaces, and the one single-digit accomplishment he can point to when it comes to his job approval numbers. President Biden gives his State of the Union address tomorrow night. He will no doubt mention several positive developments. He's overseen the lowest jobless rate of any president since 1969. More than 500,000 new jobs were created last month alone. Inflation seems to be slowing, and there have been several consequential pieces of legislation passed. But what he likely will not mention is that little seems to be registering with voters. New Washington Post, ABC News polling shows 62% of Americans say the president has achieved not very much or little or nothing in office, compared to 36% who say the opposite. Joining me now, CNN political commentators from across the political spectrum, Bakari Sellers, Karen Finney, Scott Jennings, also Jeff Duncan, former Republican Lieutenant Governor of Georgia. So, Karen, what is the problem? Why is no one seeing what the president says he's doing?
Look, I think it's a couple of things. Number one, I think folks are fatigued, and a lot of the things that we in Washington think resonate with people don't necessarily connect in their daily lives, and they don't necessarily always see it right away. But that's part of why the president's going to talk about it. It's what we call the informed vote. When we see this in polling and focus groups, when you talk about what he's done, actually, then the numbers start to change. So that's why we're going to get a laundry list. I know you wanted a short speech, but it ain't happening.
Do you think, does a State of the Union change anything? I mean, does anyone remember a State of the Union except for, like, folks on cable news?
I mean, the one line of the State of the Union that I remember is Bill Clinton once saying the era of big government was over. Mm. A pivot back to the middle, because they had lost in 94 and he was preparing to run for re-election. Karen, yeah. It was there. Yeah. And so that's what I'm waiting to see, if Biden recognizes the problems that he has. 60% of the American people think he's done very little. 60% of his own party doesn't even want him to run again. They want somebody else for the nomination. Obviously, it's just not a failure to connect with everybody. It's a failure to connect with his own people. And so I want to see how he responds to that, because they've got serious underlying political problems that they seem to be scrambling for a way to fix.
I don't think a pivot is necessary. And I think that what you're going to see is a president who's been very successful in his first 2 years in office. And that success actually showed itself at the ballot box in November. And so, unlike Bill Clinton, who got mollywopped in midterms, or Barack Obama, who got mollywopped. And it's funny, because the only thing I remember is "you lie" yelled by Joe Wilson, right? That's the only, and that wasn't even a line from a speech. That was a member of Congress. I do think you're going to get a laundry list. One of the things that this White House reminds me of the Obama White House in is that you have to do a better job of communicating your successes. Yes. And I'm not harping on the comms department per se, but what I am saying is that more Democrats would say, and there's not a correlation between him not running for office again by Democrats and his successes, because there are people who don't want him to run for office who think he's been an awesome president of the United States. But they have to get out there and share that message. I think the State of the Union, hopefully, is the beginning of a campaign, maybe not to run for office again, but at least to spread that message.
But, Lieutenant Governor, I mean, if many people in the country don't think he's accomplished much in the last 2 years, given the makeup of the House, I mean, how much is he going to be able to accomplish in the next 2 years?
Yeah, look, those numbers are horrible, right? There's no way to describe those as optimistic if you're looking at them. But I think it's because there's a disconnect, right? It doesn't feel like Joe Biden has been successful, even though the other side of the aisle, for me, sees all these successes. And it's because I think America has a hard time figuring out how he actually makes his decisions. It starts all the way with Afghanistan, right? It just seemed like a rash, isolated decision that was underinformed. And even as you go through this weekend watching this balloon incident, right? I don't want a Monday morning quarterback and figure out where to shoot that thing down at. But I feel like the commander-in-chief should have communicated to America, who is wondering what in the world is going on. The communist Chinese government has got a balloon, you know, going uncontested across our country. And trying to figure out the rationale behind his decision-making, I think, is really, really plaguing him.
But I think he's almost, in some ways, a victim of success. Like, we wanted him because we wanted back to normalcy. Imagine if we had spent 24 hours of Donald Trump tweeting every 10 seconds about the balloon. We would all be at our therapist's office right now. We would be so on edge. And I think to some degree, I mean, I spent my first holiday with my family this year. We haven't been able to see each other because of COVID. I mean, you know, we forget what it was like when he took over.
So
that,
if
and
there's
that's a good
of,
thing.
So if there's a lot of drama in the next 2 years in the House. Is that actually going to help President Biden?
Well, I think I would underscore the fact, and I think people forget this sometimes, that many of his largest successes were actually bipartisan. Mm-hmm. And so I'm not as afraid of this House. I think this House is unorganized. I think Kevin McCarthy, he is yet to be proven to be a leader. But you talk about the Inflation Reduction Act. You talk about the infrastructure bill. You talk about the things that he, or just the COVID relief packages. The things he's been able to do in a bipartisan fashion are his biggest pieces of legislation. When people will feel it, though, that's a question for later day.
Karen, you invoked Trump, so I have a question for you. Why do you think it is that Donald Trump was beating Joe Biden in this ABC News Washington Post poll? If everything's going great and he's doing everything bipartisan and everything he says is true, why do you think it is that after everything we've seen out of Trump, which, admittedly, some of which is really terrible, he's beating Joe Biden right now in a head-to-head
match. Why do you think it is?
Is that a rhetorical question, Anderson?
No, I want to know. I want to know. I mean, my views are that he got elected president because he was not Bernie Sanders and he was not Donald Trump. His job was essentially to bridge us out of that era. And that's it.
Which he's done quite
and
well.
And that's it. And now the country wants change, generational change, and they don't want him. Frankly, I don't think they want him or Trump to run for re-election, which also was borne out in the polling. But if it's so good, why are they pining for Trump again?
But here's the thing. We just had an election. We just had an opportunity for people to go to the polls. And they overwhelmingly said, we would like democracy. We would like freedom. We don't actually want extremism. And the Republicans control the House by a very thin margin. Because a lot of districts are gerrymandered. It was not this whopping.
They did win the national popular vote.
I think by the Republican side, they said they didn't want Donald Trump was a huge mandate that we saw.
No,
but also, I think we have to talk about the 800-pound grill in the room. Joe Biden is going to be 86 at the end of his second term. There's a weight to that, right? I don't think any Fortune 500 company looks to hire executives or leaders with that type of age. And certainly that weighs on people all across the country, across both sides of the aisle.
The flip side of that is the front runner until you all change your party nomination process is still Donald Trump. And to answer your question directly, the United States of America doesn't want Joe Biden or Donald Trump to run for office, period. I mean, that's just where we are. I mean, people don't want two octogenarians running for president of the United States. But I think that when we're talking about tomorrow and the job of the past, from tomorrow backwards, Joe Biden has been an extremely effective president of the United States. Now, can he sell that as somebody who is an older individual? That is a question that we will just have to answer. I would say if it's old versus new, then new will win out. Whether or not that new is Ron DeSantis or whether or not that new is Kamala Harris or Gavin Newsom, whoever that new is, whatever it is. But the fact is, if it's Donald Trump versus Joe Biden, I take Donald Trump 14 out of 14 times.
I think there's an interesting development starting on both sides of the aisle that these profiles of governors are starting to pick up, right? Mm-hmm. On both sides of the aisle. You mentioned Gavin Newsom and others. Certainly on the Republican side, you've got Ron DeSantis and Larry Hogan and Glenn Youngkin and even Brian Kemp to some respects, because they're able to put on display their conservative leadership and they're out of this fray of D.C. and all this chaos that goes on. They're actually crisp and clean leaders. I think there could be some developments on both sides.
We're going to wrap it up there. Guys, thank you very much. Appreciate it. Coming up, a lot more ahead, a serious new allegation against Congressman George Santos that goes beyond lies about his biography and questions about his finances. This just as the House Ethics Committee appears to be gathering information about Santos, and new polls reveal how unpopular he's become. Ahead. House Ethics Committee has started interviewing staffers for Congressman George Santos, a sign it is beginning to look into one or more of the many allegations involving his biography and finances. And it comes as a prospective staffer named Derek Myers says he's filed the Ethics Committee and police reports against Santos, accusing the Long Island Republican of sexual harassment. According to the House Ethics complaint, Myers says Santos touched his inner thigh and, quote, proceeded to touch my groin. CNN national politics reporter Eva McCand joins us now with the latest. So what is Santos saying about all this?
Well, Anderson, he's emphatically denying the allegation. Derek Myers came to Santos's office from Ohio, where he was working as a local reporter. Myers was charged with wiretapping last year after he published audio recorded by a source in a courtroom. That case, it's still ongoing, but that is what Santos made reference to today in his denial, suggesting this is someone who is aggrieved, essentially, because they didn't get a job. Let's listen.
any part of that that would
be. Alleging that you made an unwanted sexual advance for him.
It's comical.
Do you share if you deny the claim against you?
Of course I deny the claim against. Let me make it very clear. Let me make it clear.
Thank you.
If there was remote any part of that that were true, he should have led with that and not begged for a job that we decide to pull for it from him for being accused of doing exactly what he did to us.
And just a follow-up. So you categorically deny it?
100%.
So Myers did in fact tape a conversation with Congressman Santos and provided the recordings to the news website Talking Points Memo, but that sexual harassment allegation not in any of the published material from the site, and we here at CNN haven't been able to independently verify that recording. Myers says, though, that he filed a police report, and Anderson, as many of our viewers know, it is illegal to file a false police report.
So do we know if the House Ethics Committee is going to launch an investigation to these new allegations?
You know, we don't, Anderson, not at this stage. The House Ethics Committee, they're a bipartisan group that takes their work seriously and has a longstanding policy of not commenting. I did speak with a government ethics expert earlier this evening, and he told me this is a serious allegation that he believes the committee will, in fact, investigate. And I'm learning a little bit of how this would work. He told me that they would interview the complainant, they would interview Congressman Santos, and then they would try to interview witnesses if there were any. And then there is this separate issue of him, the complainant, working in the office for free as a volunteer under the guise of eventually getting a job. It seemed to be that that was his understanding. Well, that ethics expert telling me it's not clear that that arrangement was above board, and that may be something that the committee has to look into as well.
And is Congressman Santos attending the State of the Union tomorrow?
It sure seems that way. Congressman Santos says he's invited Michael Weinstock, a volunteer firefighter who was at the World Trade Center on 9/11 and suffers from neuropathy related to toxic exposure. You know, this would not be a head scratcher in any other case, especially for a member representing New York. But Congressman Santos repeatedly claimed his mother was at the Twin Towers on 9/11 and that her exposure to toxins played a role in her death. CNN found that immigration records show his mother wasn't even in the country at the time. So why he would raise this issue in the context of his apparent lie on this matter about his mother, Anderson, is truly puzzling.
Even McCann, I appreciate it. Thank you. I'm joined now by Harry Anton with some polling data that doesn't paint a good picture for the embattled congressman. I don't know, people are doing polling on him, but
yes.
What does it show?
So, you know, I have a general rule in politics. That is, you could get 10% of Americans to agree on anything. So 10% of Americans think the U.S. faked the moon landing. Uh-huh. Where's George Santos's favorable rating among his own constituents? It's 7%. It's 7%.
That seems high to me.
Look,
I mean, sure, who would say, like, oh, yeah, no, I think he's doing a great job.
I'm sure you could find 7% of people who are pathological liars. So, okay. No, I don't think that that's a high one. I think the fact that there are fewer constituents in New York 3 who have a favorable view of him than Americans who think we faked the moon landing is a pretty good indication that we're actually below sort of the Mendoza line of American politics, where you can get 10% of Americans to basically agree on.
So anything. If he had a sense of shame or cared about what people in his district actually thought, he might resign looking at those poll numbers.
Yeah. So, you know, they also asked in that particular poll, you know, what do you believe that George Santos should resign? 78% of his constituents said that, yes, he should resign. Now, I made a historical comparison, right, of other scandaled politicians and whether or not voters thought that they should resign at the time of their scandals. Mm. And what you can see, essentially, wow, is that Santos at 78% is higher than, say, Richard Nixon was, wow, in 1974. He was in the 60s. Right. Higher than Elliot Spitzer was back in his scandal back in 2008. And higher than Anthony Weiner was back in 2011.
And what phase of the Anthony Weiner scandal was that? Do you know?
That was taken after we found out some initial stuff. It was, okay, before he resigned. It was not of course, during his mayoral bid, okay. That was a bid, of course, in which he ended up in the single digits.
Right.
But the fact was okay. That, you know, it's obviously it's a scandal on a different level. The thing about the Santos scandal, of course, is every single day it just seems like there's a lie coming out. It almost seems like a lie a day.
It's obviously a lot of focus in New York where he is, you know, representing or allegedly representing a district. What about the rest of the country? Is there a lot of interest in
this? Yeah, so this to me is interesting, right? You know, we're in New York right now, and obviously Eva was in Washington, D.C., and so I was wondering, is this just a sort of a beltway story, right? But we can get a pretty good idea from Google searches where people are searching for George Santos, whether or not it's just really a New York story.
This is interesting.
And as it turns out, 92% of the searches for George Santos are outside of New York State.
Oh, that's interesting.
So it does give you an indication that, in fact, that there are a lot of people
nationally. I wonder if the people, because only 8% of them are in New York. I wonder if people in New York like enough of the Santos that we hear about him all the time, so but outside maybe less so.
I think the fact that we just had that previous slide that showed all those scandal-laden politicians in New York, I think maybe...
they were all New York
politicians. They were all New York politicians.
Except for Nixon.
Yeah.
Wow.
Exactly. I mean, Richard Nixon did, in fact, end up living in New York or lived in New Jersey.
Sure,
anyway.
He did. Harry Anton, always a pleasure.
Thank you, sir.
Just ahead, the latest in the double murder trial of Alec Murdoch, a big setback for his defense, plus testimony from the only witness who saw Murdoch around the time of the murders. We'll be right back. The judge in the double murder trial of Alec Murdoch delivered a severe blow to his defense today. Murdoch is a member of what was once considered a prestigious family in South Carolina, but it turns out he'd allegedly been stealing from his clients, many poor families, for years. He's on trial now, accused of killing his wife and youngest son to try to deflect attention from those alleged financial crimes the prosecutors say were about to be revealed. His attorney said the fraud claims were irrelevant, that they shouldn't be presented to the jury, but after days of testimony, the judge disagreed, and today, as well, key testimony from a witness who says she talked with Murdoch on the night of the murders and that he made her, quote, nervous. Seen as Randy Kaye has more on that.
Was it unusual to see Alex Murdoch at that residence that time of night?
Yes, on my shift, yes.
This woman is the only witness who saw Alec Murdoch around the time of the murders. Michelle Shelley Smith worked as a caregiver for Alec's mother and says Alec came to his mom's home sometime after 9 p.m. on June 7th, 2021. That would have been shortly after the state says Maggie and Paul Murdoch's phones ceased all activity, meaning they were likely dead. Alec's mother had Alzheimer's. Smith said his mom was sleeping that night and that it was unusual for Alec to come visit her so late. Smith recalled Alec stayed about 15 to 20 minutes. Despite that, she says he told her the next day, unsolicited, that he was there much longer than that.
And just to be clear, what was the statement he said about how long he was here?
30 to 40 minutes.
But his phrase was, I was here, or you know I was
here? I was here 30 to 40 minutes.
Was he there 30 or 40 minutes that night?
Not to my recall.
Smith cried on the stand as she shared how that conversation with Alec made her so nervous she called her brother to tell him about it. She seemed to suggest Alec was sending her a message to say he was there longer the night of the murders. She also described for the jury how Alec seemed fidgety. The defense pushed back.
Is his normal behavior kind of fidgety?
Yes.
Smith told the jury days after the murders, Alec returned to his mother's house around 6:30 in the morning with what looked like a blue tarp.
Holding something like this?
Yes.
And what did it look like?
Like a blue tarp, like a tarp.
Blue?
Blue.
Okay. Was it vinyl?
It's like a tarp that you put on the car, you keep your car covered up.
Did he say anything when he walked in?
No.
Okay. What did he do when he walked in?
Went upstairs.
The prosecution argued in opening statements that investigators recovered a blue raincoat at Alec's mother's home, which had gun residue on it. This special agent with SLED, the South Carolina Law Enforcement Division, told the jury she found a blue raincoat tucked away in a closet at his mother's house.
We located a blue raincoat in the coat closet on the second floor.
When we found it, it was balled up like this.
That is correct.
Still, the defense injected some doubt, getting Smith, the caregiver, to confirm she thought it was a tarp, not a raincoat.
And it was not a rain jacket, was it?
No, it wasn't.
It was a blue tarp?
Yes.
The defense also pointed out the blue item, whatever it was, didn't have a gun wrapped inside it, such as a murder weapon, which would have left gunshot residue. But the caregiver noticed more about Alec the night of the murders.
Did you observe anything about his face? Any on his face?
Thinking like a little color, a little bruise, cut or something.
And ma'am, I apologize. A little what cut?
Like a little bruise or something.
Where was it?
It's like above his forehead.
What she didn't see on Alec was blood.
Did Alec Murdoch have blood on his clothes?
No.
He had blood on his shoes?
No.
He had blood on his hair?
No.
Randy Cade joins us now. So if Alec Murdoch didn't have blood on him when he went to his mom's house, what would that mean necessarily?
Well, Anderson, based on the timing, he likely went to his mom's house after those murders had already occurred. So it could mean, if he didn't have blood on him, that he really wasn't there at the time of the murders, as he has said. Or it could mean, as the prosecutors have suggested, that he washed up and changed his clothes after allegedly killing his wife and son. Now, we know from the caregiver at the mom's house that he was wearing shorts and a white T-shirt when he showed up there, which is different than the clothing he was wearing just about an hour before the murders happened to occur on that Snapchat video that his son, Paul, had sent out. So the jury will have to decide which one they believe on that. But also, Anderson, just one note on that blue raincoat. The witness who oversaw all of the testing of the gunshot residue on that raincoat, she's going to take the stand tomorrow. She will likely say that there was gunshot residue on the raincoat, as the prosecutor has already said in his opening statement. But the trouble is, Anderson, nobody actually saw Alec Murdoch wearing that raincoat the night of the murder. So the jury will really have to connect the dots on that one.
Right. Randy Kaye, appreciate it. Thank you. Up next, we take you to Ukraine for a fascinating story. You're going to see how a 102-year-old great-grandmother is helping Ukrainian soldiers on the front lines and a report about the front lines ahead. As mentioned earlier, tomorrow night during the State of the Union address, President Biden is expected to talk about U.S. support for Ukraine with the one-year anniversary of Russia's invasion about 2 weeks away. So far, the Biden administration has committed nearly $30 billion in security assistance to Ukraine. It includes M1 Abrams tanks, which are not yet on the battlefield. Today, Ukrainian troops began training with the German-made Leopard 2 tanks, new weapons that Ukraine's President Zelensky has been pushing for. But he already has another powerful tool, namely the resilience and determination of Ukrainians refusing to leave the country, including a 102-year-old great-grandmother who's living through war again and helping soldiers on the front lines. CNN's Sam Kiley has her story.
At 102, Lyubov's survival is extraordinary, not least because she's endured three famines over her century, and all of them blamed on the Kremlin.
We ate linden leaves, and nettles. We used to grind these wild plants into flour, bake with it, and eat it.
At 13, she saw her older brother and sister perish in Ukraine's worst mass starvation, the Holodomor.
My legs were swollen. My arms were swollen. I was so sick. I thought I was going to die.
In the early 1930s, on Joseph Stalin's orders, Ukraine's farmers were stripped of every grain they produced to feed Moscow's industrialization.
Tiny children were dying of hunger. They were taken to a truck. They dug a big hole and threw them all in.
Ukraine is now 11 months into the latest Russian invasion. Three of her grandchildren are soldiers fighting Russian troops because Russia's president doesn't believe that Ukraine exists. It should be noted that Ukraine actually never had stable traditions of real statehood, Putin claimed. Russia's assault on Ukraine's capital, Kyiv, failed last year. Many Ukrainians believe they're fighting off another attempt at genocide.
The leaders and organizers of the genocide sit in the same offices in the same place. At the center of these events is Moscow, and the object of destruction is Ukraine as a nation.
Ukraine's government says thousands of citizens have been forced into Russian territory and 14,000 children are missing.
How many millions of people died in the many famines brought upon by Russia in this country over the last century is a matter of debate among historians and human rights. Lawyers will debate whether or not what is happening today can be defined as a genocide. But there's no question that over the last 100 years, the relationship between Moscow and Ukraine has been bleak.
We need to exterminate them so that not a single one is left. Only then can there be any peace.
To help the war effort, she ties burlap into netting to make sniper camouflage. But it may be her laughter that has kept her going so many years.
Sam, such a remarkable story. You're in Zaporizhia right now. What's the latest on the front lines?
Well, the front lines on this axis, as you know, run from here, basically pretty much due east. Now, they are relatively static, but there have been signs of a Russian build-up. But around Bakhmut, Anderson, there is very, very intensive fighting. Also in the city of Volodar, towns, I should refer to them both. Bakhmut is on a hill. It's a city. It is going to be, in the view of the Ukrainians, who are already debating whether or not they should hang on to it, but they believe that they can if they so choose. The issue will be whether or not it's worth it in terms of the cost of the Ukrainians, in terms of men and material behind that. At the same time, the leader of Wagner, Prigozhin, is saying he believes the Ukrainians are going to fight to the last man. But there is going to be a debate, I think, in the coming days as to whether or not it's really worth, in military doctrine, essentially reinforcing failure from the Ukrainian point of view, or whether they fall back to their defensive positions. But this has been a very bloody battle ahead, Anderson, of what is anticipated to be a Russian offensive somewhere along this 800 mile long front line sometime in the spring, Anderson.
Yeah. Sam Kiley, be careful. Thank you. Well, coming up, something to hopefully make you smile at the end of your day. We'll be right back. To end tonight, a quick story about a 9-year-old who just graduated high school. That's right. You heard me right. He's 9 and just graduated high school. According to our affiliate, David Balogun received his diploma from a charter school in Pennsylvania after taking classes remotely. David gives a lot of credit to his favorite teachers. Both of David's parents have advanced degrees, but David's mom said that raising someone as gifted as David is challenging. She says it's because he knows and understands concepts that are, quote, sometimes beyond my understanding. And now that he's graduated, David apparently has his future mapped out.
I want to be an astrophysicist, and I wanted to study black holes and supernova.
I'm not even sure what they are exactly, but I have no doubt he will do that. David's parents say they are looking at colleges right now. In the meantime, David is working on his black belt in martial arts. We wish him the best. News continues. Aaron Burnett out front starts now.
Now streaming exclusively on Max. A new CNN flash doc about the album that has Nashville talking, Call Me Country, Beyonce and Nashville's Renaissance. Watch it at max.com/callmecountry. Max subscription required.